Okay. Good morning and welcome back to Social Psychology. Welcome, school students. Nice to have you here. Today we will be talking about people in groups as one of the most important topics of social psychology, because it's also the background of social psychological applications to a number of areas. Some we will explore here in this course in the next weeks, like prejudice, racism, hate crimes, but also group behavior as analyzed by social psychologists has become the fundament for analyses, for example, of organizational behavior. And in my lecture, in my master's psychology lecture on organizational psychology, I of course also refer to people in groups quite a lot. Consider this quotation. He makes tools, and he does so within more than one technical tradition. By exploiting fire, by building shelters, by taking over parts of the nature, like caves, for example. And he needs to have some coordination, and he needs a discipline that can sustain complicated operations. So he, for example, tries to catch the wildebeest. That means some have to hide on one side of the savannah and shoo the wildebeest forward. Others have to hide behind rocks and bushes on either side to stop the wildebeest chewing out. And yet others have to hide on the other side of the savannah with spears ready to kill the wildebeest when it comes out. He also needs some ways of articulation, of communication, maybe not an articulated speech like we are using today, but he's communicating with hand gestures and facial gestures and so on. And there would also be some social discipline. The old creatures would be cared for, the young would be cared for. It wasn't that always the strongest person in the group got all the meat for him or herself. And the old creatures were the databases of these early societies. They knew where the wildebeest would be at certain times of the year. They knew what to do when the weather conditions would be changing. This is a quotation from a book called The History of the World by J.M. Roberts. And I think it's a nice example that describes how we people, humans, have always lived together. This is a picture, unfortunately not a very good one, of Aborigines in Australia. These communities lived together for 150,000, 200,000 years, and in small groups of 20 to 30 people. And only in these groups they could survive and they could progress. And I will tell you a little bit about evolutionary psychology today. I will tell you a little bit about why people join group. But I think it's always important to keep in mind that we have always lived in groups. And this has produced a genetic makeup of us humans that maintain our need for belongingness, need for affiliation, that we typically like being with groups because groups were instrumental and crucial for our survival back in these early days. So today we will be talking about people in groups. Next week, leadership, which of course cannot happen without people in groups. And then we will apply the knowledge that we have started together on topics like prejudice, discrimination, intergroup behavior. Let's quickly go back to the sample items. This time, a little more, or a few more people seem to have difficulties with the correct answer. So please, let's discuss if there are any problems remaining after I've revealed the correct answers. Last week, we talked about compliance, obedience, and conformity. Do these processes follow the same norms and standards? Are they types of social influence, theories of power and influence, or relate to different stages in a series of social pressures? 74% of those who participated in the online assessment got this one correct. And compliance, obedience, and conformity basically are types of social influence. Yes, please. So social influence is exerted by others, and this can, it depends which one you describe the process and which one you describe as the outcome. So when we look at social influence, we can measure social influence by observing people obey or comply or conform with norms. So here it's defined as the outcome, and therefore it's types of social influence. You could also say, okay, there is social influence necessary to produce these forms of behavior or forms of attitudinal change. But would that make a different answer more likely?
No, I was just at home. I was considering. Mm-hmm. I thought it was more of a result. Mm-hmm.
This is probably a more general thing in social psychology, that we often cannot directly measure the process that we describe. For example, with social dissonance, we can say that people's attitudes and behaviors are inconsistent, and therefore social dissonance would result, and we measure social dissonance by measuring people's attitude change or behavioral changes. Autokinesis was a phenomenon used by Sharif to study hypnosis, destructive obedience, norm formation, or conformity to confederates in a group. This one, many people got wrong. 58% got this one wrong. Remember the original experiment? I presented you two graphs, two figures, and people were put in a dark room with only a small light source, and because of our involuntary movement of our pupils, this light spot seems to move. And then people were first doing this alone, and then as part of a three-person group, and the people in the group started to conform to the same norm. And on the other graph, we saw that when people start out working on this task in a group and then later alone, they still maintain that norm that was produced or created in the group. So there is basically no confederate, there's no conformity to others. There's also no destructive obedience, and of course it's not hypnosis. So the correct answer is norm formation. Are there any questions? Yes, please. A norm would form, and then people conform to this norm. That's correct. You could also call it conformity in groups in general, but there was no social influence, social pressure by any experimenter or confederate, because there was no confederate. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, please.
I don't know if I remembered right, but in this experiment from Sharif, there were some confederates in the first step?
No. No, in this experiment there were no confederates at all. It was just ordinary participants. Okay, Moscovici criticized the traditional perspective of social influence for its conformity bias. This bias implies that A, social influence acts only to preserve the status quo. Researchers interpreted cultural adaptation as conformity. Intergroup convergence is interpreted as conformity. All social influence works at multiple levels, but with the same outcome. The majority has not chosen the right answer here. Remember when I introduced Moscovici? I know it was the end, towards the end of last week's lecture, and it was pretty late, but I introduced it by saying that Moscovici's main criticism was that if there was only social influence by the majority, we would never see any innovation, we would never see any change. And that's where he brought in minority influence, and we do see minority influence operating in many key stages of our development: feminism, human rights movement, protests by the students in the 1960s, etc. These are classic examples of minority influence. And the student revolts got Moscovici thinking about minority influence. So basically, social influence acts only to preserve the status quo. Was the conformity bias according to the traditional perspective? Probably this was a little difficult, a little tricky. Or do you have other problems with that question or with the answers or other suggestions? Okay, so the correct answer is social influence acts only to preserve the status quo as a conformity bias introduced by the traditional perspective coming from the majority's view. The majority exerts influence to preserve the status quo. And Moscovici challenged this and said, no, this is not true. It can also happen that minorities are influential to challenge the status quo, to change the situation. Then finally, Milgram studies, where we talked about last week a little bit. Participants who were assigned the role of administering electric shocks in Milgram study were selected for their violent predispositions. Clearly not. He invited typical participants from the local area. They were not selected for being specifically aggressive or sadistic or violent. Were they mild-mannered, softly spoken, and cautious? No, neither. They were just a random sample of the people living in the area. Recruited from the community? Yes. There were adverts in the local newspapers and on lampposts and in supermarkets. And these adverts were inviting people from the community to come to Yale University's campus and assigned to the experiments. Yes, please.
But they were reluctant to administer shocks beyond the moderate level because they had to be pushed by the experimenter to do so, right?
Okay. Because I also showed you that video that clearly showed that people were not feeling very comfortable administering these high shocks. Many people try to get out of the experiment. So in a way, you are correct. I think what this answer wanted to imply is that, yes, although they were reluctant, 65% agreed and did so. But you're right, and I will check this question again and make sure it's either not in the exam or in a different version. But the correct answer here is recruited from the community. Related to Milgram, we also put this question as a discussion topic into the forum. We talked about Gina Perry's book, Behind the Shock Machine, last week. And in that review, you find that there's one experiment described in Gina Perry's book that Milgram doesn't mention at all in his original accounts of the obedience studies. This is the so-called experiment number 4. T participants were invited to the laboratory, but this time they were invited to come as pairs and to bring friends or relatives or neighbors. And here obedience was particularly low. I think only 1 or 2% of the people agreed to administer shocks in this condition. And we asked you online, what do you think? It was 15%. It was 15% obedience. So even in this condition, imagine you would sign up to the experiment and at a given date and time you would show up in the laboratory with a relative, your partner, or a neighbor. And still 15% went all the way up to 450 volts. And Gina Perry is criticizing this experiment for very good reasons in her book. She says, what kind of damage do you do to people who come into the laboratory, and even if they are debriefed afterwards, and even if both teacher and learner then know that no real shocks have been applied, what would you feel as a teacher if you have applied 450 volts to your wife or husband, to your partner, uncle, brother, sister, or whatever? And how must this person feel being so severely penalized by you, although no electric currents did emerge? So I think Gina Perry was criticizing this experiment for very good reasons. Our question was, what do you think are the main reasons for high or low obedience in the different variations of the experiment? I showed you, I think, 15 or 14 experiments last week where we could see that obedience ranged from 0% to 65 or 67%. And one participant in the forum made a very long account of group processes being at stake. So essentially he is saying that when you enter the laboratory, you start as being one group, you and the other participant. And then there's another person, the experimenter, who is kind of the outgroup. Then by drawing the lot and making the real participant a teacher, this person becomes more part of the group of experimenters, whereas the learner becomes a member of a different group, a student, a learner, in a different room. And the different variations basically show that the more close you get to the teacher, to the experimenter, the more people are likely to administer strong shocks. The more people are close to the learner, to the other participant, the less likely they are to apply shocks. And this is exactly the thing that Steve Riker and Alex Heslam have noted in this wonderful book, Social Psychology Revisiting the Classic Studies. And in this book, there's a chapter on the obedience studies, obedience revisiting Milgram's shock experiments, and they also compare them to the Eichmann trials and the Eichmann in Jerusalem book by Hannah Arendt, Banality of Evil. And Reicher and Heslam state that Eichmann was basically not seeing the Jews as humans anymore. He was putting them in an outgroup, even further from what we normally do, categorizing people in in-groups and out-groups, but not seeing them as humans anymore. And this is called infrahumanization by Jacques-Philippe Lyons and social psychologists who have worked on this. And the term the Nazis coined was Untermensch, lower than humans. And the same is basically happening in the Milgram experiments. In the condition when you and a close friend, relative, or neighbor are showing up in the laboratory, you have a higher common identity, shared identity, and that makes you even more reluctant to administer strong shocks than when it's a complete stranger in most of the other experiments. Also, in the other variations of the experiments, in some conditions, like the classic condition I described last week, the teacher and experimenter are in the same room, the learner is in a different room, and here we have 65% shock rates. When the teacher has to put down the hand of the learner, we only see 5% of obedience, because then you feel closer to the participant again, and you may form some shared identity with the learner, with the other participant, than with the experimenter. Okay? So, yep, please.
If it's about the same distance you've got to use on television, for example, I remember there's a big catastrophe in Thailand several years ago. I was not very much involved with my feelings. I saw this, recognized it. But now with Philippines, I know some Philippine people, and so I was worried if they were suffered, and I have had a not so big distance like the Thailand news at that time.
I think so he's referring to in-group out-group differences or social distance to the other people we observe, and typically when we every night basically when we watch the news on television we see so many bad things happening, and typically we don't run to the telephone all the time and try to help and donate some money. But when the distance is reduced, when we have personal friends or relatives or people we know in the area where these catastrophes happen, then we immediately form some more sympathy, because these people are more seen as part of the in-group and not some other group I have nothing to do with. Yes, thank you. Okay, I would like to start with people in groups. So today in general we talk about the nature of groups and reasons why people join groups. We will discuss group structure and some phenomena like group norms, socialization, and we will mostly today talk about group performance. Although there are many definitions of the group, social psychologists generally agree that at the very least, a group is a collection of people who define themselves as a group, and whose attitudes and behaviors are governed by the norms of these groups. Some of you came up here using the elevator, and this is something we experience quite often. We stand together in an elevator with two or three or five other people. It's a collection of people, but typically we don't define ourselves as members of the group. But think about you standing in the elevator, and the elevator would get stuck on its way up or down. You would immediately have shared goals. You are in a way mutually interdependent and influence each other to stay calm, to make an emergency call, to get out of the elevator. So immediately you would probably define as a group with a shared goal that you are mutually trying to accomplish. So group definitions have little to do with being closely affiliated, know about each other's history, etc. Groups can form very quickly and also dissolve very quickly. And social psychologists say the minimum definition is that people define themselves as a group and who have some shared norms that they follow in their attitudes and behavior. Organizational psychologists, when they define teams or work groups, they also use shared goals, interdependence as necessary components of the definition. And let me give you one example of research by colleagues of mine from Aston University, Jeremy Dawson, who is now in Sheffield, and Michael West, who is now at Lancaster University. For several years, when they worked at Aston University in Birmingham, they did annual staff surveys for the British NHS, National Health Service. The NHS is one of the largest organizations in the world. Do you know which are the largest organizations in the world? What do you think? Which organizations have most employees? Any ideas? Any guess? Microsoft. I don't know how many people they have, but they are, as far as I know, certainly not in the top five or so.
Unilever?
don't know either, sorry. There's one organization that you might know which is in that category, we said, which has Procter & Gamble, maybe. I don't think so. I think they are all three are huge organizations, but far smaller than Walmart. Walmart has about 1 million people, and it's one of the top five largest organizations in the world. The other two in the top three are the Indian Railway and the Chinese Army. These have 1.3 and 1.5 million people working for them. And the NHS is also in the top five with about 1.1, 1.2 million people working for the British National Health Service. And Michael West and Jeremy Dawson and these colleagues have done an annual staff survey with all employees. And typically they got response rates of something like 30%. So they worked with data from more than 300,000 people. So what they did was aggregating them on a hospital trust level. So having two or three hospitals in one area combined. And what they found was when people work in groups in these hospitals, when more than 60% were working in formal teams, patient mortality was dramatically reduced. So when people are admitted to the hospital to get some emergency surgery or get an operation after hip fracture, far fewer people die in these hospitals when more people work in formal teams. But West and Dawson in follow-up studies also ask people not only, are you a member of a formal team, yes or no? But they also ask them three key questions about tapping into this definition. Do you have shared objectives? Do you have shared goals in the team you are working? Are there regular meetings to discuss these shared goals and objectives? And do you regularly interact to accomplish your objectives? And what they found was there were a few people who said, no, I don't work in a formal team at all. There were some people who said, I'm working in a formal team, and yes, all these three additional questions answered with yes as well. And there were people who were saying, I'm working in a formal team, but who answered the additional three questions only partly with yes, and said, yeah, we have some type of objectives, but we don't regularly meet and we don't mutually interact to accomplish our goals. And this Western colleagues called pseudo-teams. And what they found was when people work in pseudo-teams, it's even worse than when they not work in teams at all. Stress goes up, bullying between colleagues and also colleagues and patients goes up, errors and mistakes go up. So it seems that in the workplace, when we work in teams, it's also necessary that we work in the right teams, that we do have shared goals, that we do interact from time to time, and that we mutually interact and engage in an interdependent way to accomplish our shared objectives. And I found this study, or these studies, so interesting because patient mortality is one of the hardest variable I can imagine. As psychologists, we are often asked, particularly when we work in organizational psychology, to try to get data that is hard data. People's performance, or at least ratings of supervisors about people's performance. And sometimes it's difficult. And in social psychology, we often use people's attitudes as dependent variable. But patient mortality, counting how many people die in every given year, and relating this to psychological processes of working in teams or not, I think it's a very, very convincing way of showing that group work is important at work, but that it is also important to get group work right and not only introduce teams because it's a recent fad, fashion to do so. Okay. People may join or form groups to get things done, which they cannot do alone, or to gain a sense of identity. We have talked about social identity already quite a lot. To obtain social support from others, or simply for the pleasure of social interaction. And one theoretical approach that addresses these questions by assuming that the behavior of all living things is determined by attempts to meet the goals of survival and successful reproduction. All living things, including human beings, have the goals of survival and reproducing. And evolutionary psychology tells us why it is helpful to live in groups. And I've started with this account with a little quote that we heard at the beginning. Groups help us reproduce successfully by providing a set of readily available and acceptable mates. That sounds a bit awkward, doesn't it? We join groups, we are members of groups, because these groups provide us with a set of readily available and acceptable mates. Which means it's more likely that you become partners here in this lecture theater than that you become partners with people in the lecture theater next door of students who may study philosophy or biology or economics. Because the group in this room comprises people with same interests, same backgrounds, and it tells you if I join this group, then it's more likely that the mate I might find in this group is not only available, but also acceptable to my in-group, to my peer group, my parents, etc. And that's one of the reasons why we join groups. It provides us with potential mates. Groups also provide us with security and the means of defense, particularly at the early times, 100,000 years back. People could only survive the attack from the wild animal because they were living together in groups. Today, it's probably not this type of physical security we are looking for when we're in group. We are under attack far less often than we have been in these early days of mankind. But it's still important to have groups that provide shelter and these things. Without groups, there would be no houses, no lecture theaters, etc. Yes, please. Certainly, we can differentiate between, and I think I've made this distinction some lectures ago, between membership groups, so we are members in a variety of groups that don't mean anything to us, and we are members in reference groups that we look up to, that we want to identify with, and we are far more guided by the norms of these groups. And think about adolescents, young youth, young people sometimes are people in membership groups like church communities that they don't want to identify with, where their parents think they would probably provide acceptable partners, but they are far more affiliated or attracted to their peer groups that probably don't provide the acceptable mates in the eyes or view of their parents, but in their own views, they do. Yes, it's true. So there are some groups we are members of, and they don't have any meaning. Sometimes we actively try to dissociate from these groups. But still, they would, in principle, provide mates and security. Yeah, and groups allow better opportunities for food gathering, production. This was true in the early days, as this is true today. Farmers don't work alone on their farms anymore, but work in collectives and in groups. There are a lot of things that can't be done alone. There are others that we could do alone, but they simply aren't as much fun as if they were doing them in groups. We don't like to be alone. We don't like to be isolated. We will talk about this in the last lecture of this series about attraction. And therefore, we also frequently use working groups to make important decisions. The question, however, whether groups actually perform better and make better decisions is a very complicated one. Later on, we will talk about group performance, and we see that factors like social loafing or free riding tell us a little bit about that sometimes group performance is lower than individual performance. Next week, when we talk about leadership and decision making, we also see that groups are sometimes not as good in decision making as we think they are or may be. Group membership also provides us with more well-being. When we are affiliated and feel accepted by others, we stay more healthy. We are more able to cope with threats from the environment. When we identify with others, we are more likely to elicitate social support from others, and therefore we are better able to cope with stress. And also, final point, our own worth, our self-esteem, is a measure of how much we feel we are accepted by others. When we are refused, when we are rejected, when we are ignored by others, it feels bad and it terribly hurts our self-esteem. So the more groups we are a member of and the more we can feel accepted by others, the higher, the more positive we think about ourselves. Now, group membership is a dynamic process. It's not the case that we either are or are not members of the groups. For many groups, our sense of commitment to the group varies. We also occupy different roles at different times. Sometimes we endure sharp transitions between these roles. And the group has many opportunities to socialize us and is utilizing different ways to do so. And this is a model by Moreland and Levine. Moreland and Levine say it's basically a five-stage model. It starts with investigation. So both the group wants to get some information about the potential new member, and the new member also wants to gain information about the group. When we talk about work organizations, for example, this is a very formal process of recruitment. So there would be a job advert, and the potential new members see the advert, and then they ask for more information or look for more information on the internet or by talking to others who are already working for the organization. And of course, the organization does the same thing and ask for information from the group member, the potential new member. Please send us your CV, please send us some references, etc. Entry is a transition point, and then either the potential new member becomes an organization member or not. So either someone is hired and appointed or not. In many other groups, this is also happening, but a very informal process. Think about peer groups you sometimes became a member of in your past. There's no formal recruitment procedure. There's no CV that you have to send somewhere. But sometimes it's quite difficult to become members of groups. Sometimes it's easy. And both sides look for some information whether I would fit into the group. And the existing members look for fit of the potential new member. The new member then is kind of socialized by the group, but again, it's a two-way process. The group tries to assimilate the new member into the group. This is what we typically have in mind, what ethnic minorities coming to Germany should do. They should assimilate. They should start speaking German and German only. They should give up their original culture and become Germans, celebrating the German traditional Christian holidays, etc., etc. On the other hand, the individual new members also tries to accommodate the group's view on his or her strengths, positive things, things that are valued in their traditions, like ethnic minority members trying to bring in more interesting things into the German culture. This is what sociologists and psychologists and sometimes political scientists refer to as integration, a best of both approach. Someone coming to Germany, maintaining some of the original traditions that work well also in a different context, and the German society benefiting from us, from this, but at the same time, of course, everyone moving to a different country also has to assimilate in some ways. And when this works well, then people are accepted by the group. So this is the next transition phase, and then we are a full member of the new group, and we maintain our status. And in this figure, it looks as if all these transitions are of equal duration, which of course is not normally true. These two phases are typically much shorter, and these as well. And this is typically the longest stage. So we are a full member for quite some time. When we enter an organization, like a university, as your students do, you inquire about the organization. The organization, the university, requires you to submit your high school diploma, and then you are either accepted or not. And this can go very quickly. You all know in the bachelor program, when you finish your high school, you have about a couple of weeks' time to find out which universities offer the program that you would like to study, and then you apply at a couple of universities, and then in October you are either told that you can become a member or not. And this happens quite quickly. This happens a little, this takes a little longer, so it takes you a few weeks or months in the first semester or the first semesters to become a fully accepted member of the group. But then you stay in a university for 3 years, sometimes 5 years, sometimes even longer. Some people stay with us for almost their entire career. They become bachelor students, master students, do their PhD, stay on as postdoc researchers, and stay for 12 years, 15 years in the same university. Sometimes people start diverging from the group's view, norms, and standards, and either then they change the group's norms, or they change their own attitudes, and then they become full members again, or they realize that the divergence is too high, that their views are different from the group, and then over time they become marginal members, and finally they exit and become ex-members. Well, at the workplace, this often happens. People stay for 20 or 30 years in an organization, but close to retirement, often people experience that they don't fit as much as they did in the past, because all their colleagues are much younger now, and they are used to use different technologies. They have different backgrounds, different trainings, and people close to retirement often only feel as marginal group members. And at the retirement age, with 65 or 66 or whatever, they exit the group, and then they are ex-members. And this is characterized by remembrance. Both the group remembers the former members, and the group, the former members remember how it was at the time when they were still group members. And this is a dynamic process, because these phases can take different times. There can be particularly at times of divergence, there can be re-socialization into the group or exit, and then you have constant membership change. The group also changes its appearance by role negotiations with new members that frequently or constantly join the group. And when with every new person who joins the group, role negotiations may also mean that the group changes its nature. Like German society has changed over the last 20 years because of the feeling that we are more and more a country of immigration. and because of the immigration law that was put into practice in, I think, 1998. And smaller groups do likewise. So in smaller groups of 5 or 6 people, of course, getting a new group member who starts accommodating the group's norms at the same time when he or she assimilates to the group, starts negotiating his or her role in the group, will change the group's appearance. Okay? So it's a dynamic process. Now, let's talk about group performance. And I think most of the remaining time of the lecture we will talk about group performance from various angles. One of the key findings is that people tend to perform easy, well-learned tasks better, but difficult, poorly learned tasks worse when other people are present. And I will show you why we are affected by this. This is a model by Bob Zients. Bob Zients is a famous researcher in the US who in 1965 developed social facilitation theory. And Bob Zients' model was quite simple. He said when others are present, then we feel some sort of arousal, physiological arousal, that we would not feel when no one would be present. This arousal leads to a higher likelihood for showing the dominant response, whatever the dominant response be in the respective context. Now, if the dominant response is correct, Zients says this is social facilitation. We produce more or better or perform at a higher level. When the dominant response is incorrect, Zients says this is social inhibition and we perform poorly, produce not as much, etc. And this is a classic example by Hazel Marcus. Hazel Marcus invited participants into the laboratory and asked them to simply undress and dress again with their own familiar clothes in one condition. This is the blue line. Sorry. The blue line. In the other condition, they had to dress and undress with unfamiliar clothes. It was, for example, a lab coat that had that were closed from the on the back, and some special shoes and gloves. So unfamiliar clothes. You see, when people were asked to dress and undress with familiar clothes, there was no difference whether they did it alone or when there was an audience that was not paying attention to them. Just some other people in the same room, but no audience that was paying attention. When there was an attentive audience, however, so research confederates or other participants that were observing the participants dressing and undressing, you see that the time taken to dress and undress was far shorter. In our familiar clothes, the dominant response is the correct response. We know how to button or unbutton a shirt because we do it every day. We know how to lace our shoes because we do it every day. So when we are aroused by the presence of an attentive audience, we are more likely to show the dominant response, and the dominant response is the correct response and leads us to perform on a higher level. We are faster. But you see that when we are dressing with familiar clothes, an incidental audience that doesn't pay any attention doesn't change anything because it doesn't lead to arousal. When we are dressing and undressing with unfamiliar clothes, you see the picture looks completely different. People, when people are alone, they need a little longer. They need about 10, 12 seconds more to dress and undress. When they are with an audience, they need much more time, so another additional 15 seconds. And this time it doesn't matter whether the audience is paying attention or not. Even an incidental audience leads to some arousal, and this arousal leads to the dominant response, which in this case is the incorrect one. So people may start looking for the buttons on the front of the code, but they can't find any. And until they realize that they have to open and close the code from the back, they have already lost a few seconds again. So the dominant response that is that increases because of the arousal is the incorrect response. Okay? Yes, please. Okay. That's a very interesting thought. So she said that maybe sociophobia is also related to this phenomenon, and that people are probably behaving strangely because they are aroused by the other people and because they think that because of the other people being around and their arousal, they behave incorrectly. And then maybe it becomes some sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah.
Or it's also their dominant answer is correct.
Incorrect.
In this case,
that's what. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. It's a good thought or idea. Baron and Byrne came up with a slightly more complicated model. The physical presence of other people can be distracting and does produce some conflict. Conflict between attending to the task or paying attention to the audience. And while distraction alone impairs task performance, of course, when we are distracted, when we don't focus on the task, but when we are torn between task and the others, this distraction alone would reduce our performance. But at the same time, this conflict also produces some arousal again or some drive that again may facilitate the dominant response. And together these processes impair the performance on difficult tasks because drive overcomes distraction, but improves performance on easy or simple or well-learned tasks. So it's essentially the same model as Bob Zients's model, but slightly more elaborate. So the presence of an audience or co-actors leads to attentional conflict between paying attention to the audience or the task. This again leads to arousal, and this leads to social facilitation or inhibition. There's one interesting study by Baumeister and Steinhilber, who found that professional athletes frequently performed poorly in crucial games played in front of their own fans. This is something we find counterintuitive, because normally in soccer or football, we know that it is an advantage to have a home game rather than an away game. Baumeister and Steinhilber looked at athletes doing individual sports. So when people do individual sports, and these are professional athletes, so they should do it on a high level anyway, and for them it should be also a well-learned task, but it's probably things that are not very simple or are not very easy. So it's quite, maybe it's something like hurdle jumps and these things. They do require a lot of attention. And when these professional athletes are torn between people they know and they know expect a lot of them, probably this little additional conflict makes them performing a little less good because of this attention being taken away from the task. I found this study quite interesting. There's a meta-analysis by Bond and Titus. They reviewed over 200 studies with over 20,000 research participants, and they did indeed find strong confirmation that simple tasks, performance on simple tasks increased, performance on more difficult tasks decreased in the presence of others. And Bob Zients in 1965 wrote the first paper on social facilitation in the journal Science, one of the major journals for all natural science disciplines. And he found that dogs ran faster, chickens ate more feed, ants built bigger nests, and rats had more sex when other dogs, chickens, ants, or rats were around. So even animals seem to be distracted between paying attention to the task, whatever that is, and the audience. However, tasks do not only differ in difficulty, but also in structure and objectives. Whether a task benefits from a division of labor and how individual task performances are interrelated also have implications for the relationship between individual and group performance. Steiner came up with a taxonomy of a number of factors. We see a few in a moment that say sometimes individual performance should be better, sometimes group performance should be better, because sometimes we have tasks like mountaineering, climbing a mountain. This is typically a task that is dependent on the weakest link in the chain of climbers. In others, it's the best group member that produces performance of the group, and in some other tasks, it's just the average of the individual group member's performance, for example. In general terms, and I will show you a lot of studies in a moment, people tend to put less effort into task performance when they work in groups than when they work alone. There are a few factors, however, that help overcoming this effect. For example, when the task is involving and interesting, or when the individual contribution is clearly visible, or when the group is important to the people's self-esteem or self-definition. In all these cases, sometimes people can perform better in a group than when they work alone. And the first one who studied this was a German psychologist, Ringelmann, and exactly 100 years ago he published the first paper, which was then called the Ringelmann effect. He investigated the ability of individuals to reach their full potential when working together on tasks. They had to they were engaged in rope pulling. And this is an additive task. So when you have two persons pulling on a rope, the force of the two individuals should just add up to the total force exerted on the rope. When you have three, four, or five people, the task performance, the force that is put on the rope, should be higher. And of course, Ringelmann did find that when adding individuals to the group, this increased the overall amount of pulling on the rope. He also found substantial process losses. So this is the expected performance per person, and this was the actual performance that Ringelmann found. So when you have two people in the group, the average force that was exerted by each group member was a little lower than the expected performance. When you have seven or eight people, you see that there was quite a difference. So eight people exerted force of about 40 kilograms, although individually they were all capable of pulling with 70 kilograms. Of course, an eight-person group, 8 times 40, still exerts more force than a four-person group, 4 times 50. 4 times 50 would be 200 kilograms, so 4 people would exert less power or less force than 8 people, 300 kilograms. But the individual level of performance would go down the more people you add to the group. Why is that? Because of process losses during task performance. And we can distinguish between two types of process losses: coordination loss and motivation loss. It's more difficult to coordinate many people than to coordinate few people or individuals. The maximum Performance can only occur on the rope pulling exercise or task, for example, when all participants put forth their greatest effort at exactly the same time. This is why the people steering the rowing boat are so necessary. But despite best efforts, it's difficult to perfectly coordinate the input of group members, and this leads to coordination loss, and therefore actual productivity in the group is reduced. And it becomes more problematic the more people you put together. Motivation losses are also process losses, but these occur when the individuals do not work as hard in the group as they could and as they do when they work alone. And this is sometimes referred to as social loafing. And these losses have been found in many different experiments. There are also meta-analyses available, and I show you one or two of the classic experiments. In a study by Latané, who also coined the term social loafing, groups of either two or six participants were instructed to shout as loud as they could. They were blindfolded, and they wore headsets with very loud music, so they didn't see the other participants, nor could they hear the other participants shouting. But they knew that they were standing in a room, either in groups of two or in groups of six. And on some trials, the participants were told via the headphones that they would be shouting alone. On other trials, they were told that they would be shouting with the other participants. So imagine you are in a room with one other person, or you are in a room with five other people. You cannot see them, you cannot hear them, and over the headphone you are instructed, please shout now as loud as you can, and you will do so with the six other people in the room. Or you are told, please shout as loud as you can now, and we are asking you alone to shout. But you simply don't know whether you are alone or not. You have to trust the experiment. And in some cases, participants were indeed shouting alone when they thought they were shouting in a group. And Latané, with this experimental setup, could measure the contribution of each individual, both when they thought they were shouting alone and when they thought they were shouting in a group of two or six people. And this is basically the result. This, again, is the potential performance of each group member. In the pseudo groups, this was when they were either working with two or with six people, and when they were told, you are shouting now as a group, please shout as loud as possible now, but in fact, it was only the individual who was shouting. There's no coordination loss. There's only one individual. And the researchers measured the difference in individual performance when they thought they were shouting with one other or with six other people compared to the control group where only one person was shouting as loud as he or she could. So in the pseudo group, it is only due to a motivation loss, only due to reduced effort or social loafing by the participants because there was nothing coordinate. In the trials when two or six people were shouting and actually shouting as a group, we also see that there's some coordination loss. There was one microphone in the room, and when the instruction came, please shout as loud as possible now, then probably some people shouted or started shouting already before the command start now came in. Others started 2 or 3 seconds later, and therefore at the time when it was measured, we have a coordination loss plus a motivation loss that people who thought they were shouting with six others were also reducing their effort. Yes, please. No, but they were given the instruction as people of six or two, and they were asked, please start shouting now. And then the microphone was recording the decibels half a second after the command. And as I said, some people started a little later and others a little earlier. Yes, please.
So how do we, I don't understand
Yeah, yeah, this is all, on these graphs, it's all individual performance. Or here it's percentage reduction in the individual shout. But it's always the individual, it's not the group.
Yes, but yeah.
You mean here?
Yes.
Hey, you have six people.
Yeah.
And six people are told, we are asking you to shout as a group now. Yeah. Please shout now.
Yes.
Then as an individual, you don't hear or see the others. You have to start shouting now. A, you know that you are shouting with five others. So you probably reduce your maximum a little.
That is just a motivation.
Yeah. And you are starting to shout maybe a little too late or maybe a little too early, and then you are over the maximum already when the microphone starts recording.
But they then measured the performance, so the whole performance at one time, and then they divide.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sure. The same or very similar study was done by Ingham and colleagues in 1974, this time with rope pulling. And I think this was done with Confederates. So the Confederates were either pretending to pull or not pretending to pull in the pseudo group team. So people were pulling the rope with two, three, four, five, or six others. And the real participant was always stating first in line at the rope. And the three, four, five other people behind him were confederates of the experimenter and were not really performing. So when the participant thought that there were others behind them and that they were pulling as a group, but in fact there was only the individual performing, you see the motivation loss again. So when there are two, three, four people, there's a, after the second person is added, there's already social loafing. When there are real participants, two, three, five, four, or six, you see that there's also a coordination loss because they don't always pull on the rope at the exact same time with the exact maximum force. Okay? I think these are cleverly designed experiments with the Confederates here, with the blindfolded and headsets in the shouting experiments, because we can differentiate so nicely between the two factors and disentangle what process loss is due to coordination problems and which part of the process loss is due to reduced effort because people thought, okay, there are five others, I don't need to pull as hard as I potentially could. Okay. I mentioned most of this already. We talk about free riding in a moment. So an individual can perceive his or her input to the group as important or not. When you are part of a team that pulls on a rope and you are the weakest group member, you could think that my performance is probably not key to the group performance. When you are the strongest member, this looks obviously a little different. When you're part of a team that has to solve complicated mathematical problems, and you know that your mathematical ability is not very high, then you would probably reduce your effort, and this is called free riding. We will get to that in a moment. The group factors that determine the amount or the extent of process losses and social loafing in particular is, first of all, group size. As groups get bigger, they have more trouble also coordinating their efforts. And increases in group size also produce motivation losses, because when there are more people, or the more people there are, the more we feel that our contribution is dispensable. When there are 10 people pulling on a rope or shouting as loud as they can, probably it's not due to my own contributions so much as when we are only two or three, or if I'm alone, of course. Another important factor that affects social loafing is group norms for appropriate effort. Group norms for appropriate effort. I don't know how many of you worked next to your studies or did work between high school and studies. When I worked as a student in the semester holidays, I often worked in some production factories, and I sometimes worked on assembly lines. And one year I worked on an assembly line for Siemens checking telephones. So this was an assembly line with telephones waiting there in the line for the next years to come. And there were four or five women I worked with who performed this task for several years. It was not a very interesting task, and after some days of practice, I knew how I could be particularly fast. And then these women were telling me, please stop working so fast, because we will sit here for the next years. You will leave in a month again. But when you set the wrong standard and our supervisor knows that we could do it a little bit faster, then this will become the new norm. And we don't want this, because obviously we also know how to produce a little bit more in the same time. But we need that extra time to have a cigarette a couple of times, or to go to the toilet, or just relax a little bit or have a chat. So groups quickly define group norms, sometimes not for maximum effort, but for appropriate effort. In organizational psychology, in about 1910, Frederick Taylor started the industrial the scientific management approach. He wanted to find out how can we best do every single thing. So he measured and counted, and then he suggested we can divide every task in subtasks, and then we have to find the exact right person and train him or her to do nothing else than this task. And Henry Ford picked this up and started with the assembly lines. And assembly lines were obviously a very important factor contributing to more and more productivity, but it also had downsides. People didn't particularly like working on assembly line and doing the same specialized job day in and day out. And in the 1930s, Rüdlisberger and Dixon did studies at the Hawthorne Electrical Plant, Western Electrical plants at Hawthorne, therefore they were called the Hawthorne studies later on. They, for example, observed women in a room producing relays. And originally, Rüdlisberger, Dixon, Mayo came also from the scientific management approach, and they played around with some of the variables they could influence. So, for example, they increased the level of light. And what they found was an increase in productivity. Okay, they thought, that's good. But what happens when we reduce the level of light? Maybe we can save energy and still the women would produce the same number or an even higher number of relays. And they did. Then Rüdlisberger and colleagues reduced the level of light even further down to the level of moonlight. And the women still produced more. And then they did something that was revolutionary. What they did was they were talking to the women. They were asking, what do you do? Why do you perform higher? How do you like the light? And the women were telling them, the researchers, oh, we are producing more because it's the first time that someone is paying attention, that someone is around and looks what we are doing and is talking to us. This doesn't happen very often here. And this brought Rüdlisberger and Dixon to develop the human movement into organizational psychology and the management literature. And they found that many factors are influenced by people factors and not purely by specialization and technology and getting the assembly line on the right speed, etc. And one thing they found, that workers who worked too hard were ostracized by the other group members. They were often labeled rate busters, and they were isolated. People started or stopped talking to them, and people don't like that. And that quickly makes them go back to the appropriate norms of performance or behavior. And when there is a strong group identity, when members care about their groups, the amount of social loafing is reduced. I will show you one or two examples in a moment. In general, tasks that are more rewarding and interesting to perform produce less social loafing. You easily can imagine that. When you stand on an assembly line and you do the same very simple thing every day for years and years, it's not very interesting, it's not very rewarding, and if you see an opportunity and if you see that 20 other people are doing the same job, then you're probably tempted to loaf a little bit more than when you are alone or when the task is interesting and rewarding. Unfortunately, there are many tasks that are not interesting, that are not rewarding. Many people, for example, at Frankfurt Airport who do very simple thing at check-in or luggage control, luggage handling, etc., do not necessarily do things that are interesting and rewarding, but still some people have to do these jobs. And the tasks therefore have to be presented as personally important so that people are involved what they are doing. And even if it's not very interesting, it's important because I serve the customers well who want their luggage at the destination right in time and who will be satisfied when this happens. Sometimes also this is very difficult to achieve because it's jobs that customers don't particularly value, like customs control, security checks. These are very difficult tasks, which are simple, which are not rewarding, not interesting, and the customers are not very happy with you doing your job in the first place. This was research by Stephen Zaccaro. Stephen Zaccaro has asked participants to come into the laboratory and to fold little moon tents, as he called them, moon tents out of a piece of paper. And they did this either in a low or high task attractiveness condition. In the low task attractiveness condition, they just said, oh, it's paper things and just for the exercise, just for our experiments. In the high attractiveness condition, they said, oh, it's moon tents, and it's an exercise from the NASA that is also used with astronauts. And they told them in this condition, and we will compare your performance to the performance of other teams. And you see, when the task is of low attractiveness, people in two-person groups produce, on average, the individual productivity this is, in two-person groups produce more than in four-person groups. This is a typical social loafing effect. When the task was of high attractiveness, however, you see that this effect is reversed, and people in four-person groups produce even more than people in the two-person groups. Some years ago, colleagues at Marburg University and I did a similar experiment. We asked teachers to come into the laboratory, and we thought to use a task that should be interesting and motivating for the teachers in and of itself. So we told them, we are describing to you situations of disruptive student behavior, and we are looking for your ideas how to deal with these students, how to deal with these problems. Oh. Every teacher in the whole experiment, no matter which group they were in or condition they were in, were sitting in front of their own computers. We were giving them the instruction over the monitor, and we were telling them, please type in every idea you have, and after you put in an idea, press enter and then type in the next idea, and you have some 10 minutes to do so. The three conditions varied in a way that in this condition we put them in individual cubicles, and we told them, and we are interested in every single teacher's idea, and we will, ideas, and we will look into your ideas specifically, and from every teacher, we will select the best ideas and put them in a little manual that we will make available to other teachers in training courses for aggressive student behavior later on. And then we had two group conditions. In the low salience group condition, we were putting them also in individual cubicles. They had the same task to do, but we told them we are not interested in the ideas of individual teachers. We will collect the ideas of the three teachers working together in this room as a group now, and we will select the best ideas for the manual. So teachers in this condition knew that we were individually looking at each of their ideas. Teachers in this condition knew that we were only looking at the ideas generated by the group. In fact, of course, we could count the individual ideas, but they thought we were only looking at the ideas produced by the group. In this condition, as you see, we put them around a table. They were still working on individual computers and monitors. There was no real interaction whatsoever. And we told them, oh, and by the way, we will compare the performance of this group with the performance of another group of teachers working in a different room in the laboratory. The results showed that this was the individual condition. On average, every teacher produced 17.8 ideas. And this was slightly reduced in the group condition low salience. So this was a typical social loafing effect. And as you can see, the group that was working around the table and was told that we would compare their ideas with other groups engaged in what we call social laboring. So they did not only overcome the effect of social loafing, in fact, they produced more ideas than in the individual condition because this competition that we introduced and the feeling of groupiness made the exercise more important to them and they produced more ideas. This was significant after controlling for the baseline number of ideas. And now we wanted to know, is this effect due to the assumed increase in team identification? So in each of the three conditions, we asked the teachers, how strongly do you identify with the teachers that you just did the exercise with in the same room? And you see that in the individual and group condition, there was not much difference. But in the high salience condition, we found a significant improvement in identification. And in additional analyses, we also did mediation analyses, and we found that teachers in the high salience group condition produced more ideas because they were more strongly identified. So when the group becomes important, social loafing is reduced, and sometimes, as in our experiments, even reversed. Yes, please. No, with the group. With the group. Mm-hmm. Not with the task. One could also ask about the task, maybe for your bachelor thesis, you could ask about both and then see what's the real reason. Is it the competition? Is it the group that gets more important because of the condition? Or is it probably that the task is looked at with more interest when we have this condition? All of this may be true. Mm-hmm. But here we ask for group identification. Okay, I already said that in larger groups, people become de-individuated, so their unique contribution to the task is not identifiable. And in the Latané et al. Study, when each individual was given their own microphone, so in the original condition that I showed you before, there was one microphone in the room that recorded people's shouting. And in another condition, Latané et al. Gave each participant their own microphone, and so therefore believed that their own input could be measured, and here virtually no social loafing emerged. People may also exert effort on tasks in part so that others will see that they are working hard. And Harkins and Jackson tested this hypothesis and found that when participants thought that answers on a task would be attributed personally to them, they worked harder than when they believed the answers were made anonymous, similar to our study with the school teachers. Free riding is a variation of social loafing. It's another motivation loss. It also happens when people rely on the group performance, on the other group members to do the work for the group. But this time it occurs when the group members monitor the behavior of the other group members and learn that their own behavior is dispensable, such as the one person who is not an expert in mathematics and who sees that there is a mathematics expert in the group, and when it comes to solving mathematical problems, this person can say, I'm not so important here, I probably go and get us some food. Or he may say nothing and just sit there. This would be free riding. It would also be a motivation loss, because when you would look at the individual performance, you would have one or some group members who perform not at all or at a much lower level. But this time it's not because this person is not feeling identifiable, but because this person is feeling that his contribution is dispensable. And of course, whether something is dispensable or not depends on whether the task is disjunctive or conjunctive. This is some of the classifications that Steiner made when the performance of the group is dependent on the worst or the best group member. Yeah, I already mentioned this, and I don't know how this could happen, but we are ready a few minutes early. We put on this question for the discussion board on the MOOC. It's also about social loafing. We give you a few ideas for why this happens, and we are very interested in receiving examples from your own context, and I hope that you participate and that next week I can share some of these ideas with you. Thank you very much. I wish you a nice week.